This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. The redwood trees of California, you know, they are iconic symbols of the Golden State. And if you've stood at the base of one of these ancient giants and you've looked straight up into the canopy, you know the experience can be transformative. But there's one feature that might be just as thought-provoking as the redwood tree in California. Any guess? I'm talking about the fog. If you drive along Route 1, you're bound to be fog-bound toward dusk somewhere along the day. And you may not realize it, but these two famous features of the California coast, the redwoods and the fog, are linked together. My next guest has studied their relationship and is here to reveal how the drought and climate change are affecting these towering trees. Todd Dawson is professor of integrative biology and environmental science policy at the University of California, Berkeley. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Nice to have you. Tell us how is rain? Now we know about fog and rain. Is fog different than rain? How they both affect the redwood tree?
Yeah, it really is. I mean, the fog, of course, comes in off of the ocean in a horizontal way, and it's kind of pulled onto shore each night as the Central Valley of California heats up, the air rises, and when that air rises, of course, it draws the fog banks in. Where rainfall, of course, comes out of the Gulf of Alaska here in California, and it, of course, falls directly vertically out of the sky. So one form of water is coming down vertically, and the other one's coming in during the summer months horizontally.
You know, we kind of think of water as water, you know. Does it affect the tree? Is there something different in one kind of water in the water itself?
Well, you know, the important things about the fog bank are kind of twofold. A, they come during the summer months when we don't have any rainfall here in California during our Mediterranean climate. And not only do they bring water when they come in off the ocean, they also bring other nutrients that are kind of dissolved in the fog, things like nitrogen. And we know all plants really require quite a bit of nitrogen to grow. And so they're getting both water and nutrients from the fog banks.
Gosh, I didn't think so. The fog is sort of fertilizing the plant.
Indeed, it is. Yeah.
Wow. Does it help the trees grow if it's sort of a natural fertilizer with the nitrogen in it?
It definitely does. We've published some work where we've shown that this fog that comes in, as I said, you know, it provides both a subsidy of nutrients and a subsidy of water, and it comes during a very, very important time in the year for that tree, during the long summer months when the temperatures are warm and the growing seasons are long. So these resources are really important for redwood trees.
Now, I read that you conducted a study where you can actually see when the tree was fed by fog or rain, and you do that through the tree rings.
Absolutely. Yeah, it was one of the coolest things. We didn't know if it was going to work, but when we got some tree cores out of these trees and we analyzed actually different parts of a single year's worth of growth, we could see in the cellulose that's being made by that tree, a signature of either winter rainfall at one part of the year or summer fog during the other time of the year.
What's different about the cellulose from one to the other?
Well, the main thing is that cellulose, as we all know, is composed of a bunch of different elements. And some of those elements are carbon, some are hydrogen, and some are oxygen. And the hydrogen and the oxygen in the cellulose come from the water. And we know that by analyzing sort of the chemical composition of winter rainfall versus summer fog, they carry sort of different fingerprints. And because of that, that gets also locked into the cellulose that's made in that tree ring.
Does the stuff that may come up through the roots have a different composition than what's coming up in the fog?
It can at certain times of the year because if the fog drips into the soil and is being taken up by the roots, then some of that will come in directly up through the root system itself. But one of the other things that we discovered about fog during the summer months is not only can it be taken up by plant root systems, but it can also be directly absorbed through the leaves, directly into the canopies.
Wow. That's interesting. I know that these trees can live for, 600-800 years or more? Have you seen any patterns in climate change? You're studying these tree rings over all this time.
Well, you know, these trees can live to be much older than that. In fact, I think the oldest coastal redwood tree is known to be more than 2,500 years old. So we've got a couple of millennia of tree rings that we can go back and look at. And we have been doing that. And one of the things that we've been discovering is that when you take the long view by analyzing both the tree ring widths and also their isotope composition, we begin to see some cycles of drought and rainfall and fog that show up repeatedly in the long tree ring record. So these redwood trees definitely are good recorders of climate and climate change.
So you can actually see in the tree rings the evidence.
Absolutely.
And I know that California is in its fifth year of a drought, but the coastal redwoods are actually growing at a faster rate. Does that have to do with the fog or what was happening there?
Well, we think that in some of the places where coast redwoods grow, and that's mostly in the northern part of their range, they do seem to show an increase in growth. We don't know exactly why that's happening, but one of the hypotheses that's out there that needs to be further tested is that as the fog has actually declined over the last 60, 70 years, the light has actually increased. And it may be that these trees are growing more because there's actually more light for them to grow on, because that's what photosynthesis actually requires. But we don't see that growth spurt all places throughout the redwood range. If you go down to the southern part of the redwoods, we see that the growth actually hasn't increased. And it might be because in that part of the range, it's already a lot warmer, there's less rain input, and there's also less fog input. So it's not universally true that all redwoods are growing better along the coast.
So you're actually seeing the effects of the drought then in the southern part of the state.
We see it more so in the southern part of the state, and we certainly see it in other parts of the state. So, of course, you know that there's two redwood trees here in California, one that grows along the coast and one that grows up in the Sierra Nevada mountains. And the ones in the Sierra Nevada, along with all the other trees that live up there, they're the ones that are really feeling the drought. And that's actually where we see not only decreases in tree growth, but increases in tree mortality.
Now, I know there are groups that are out there cloning trees to combat climate change. What do you think of this plan?
Well, I find it an interesting idea that these guys are largely horticulturalists. They're going out there, they're climbing some very large trees, getting the new rapidly growing foliage, and then they're tissue culturing these with the idea that some of these big trees probably have genetic superiority in terms of their ability to grow fast and sequester carbon. So the idea is an intriguing one. I'm not sure whether or not we can actually grow enough redwood trees to make a difference on carbon sequestration across our planet, but I think the idea of trying to do something like this has some merit.
Given climate change and the drought in California, what is the future of redwood trees here?
Well, it's a really good question, and it seems that during this five-year drought, the trees up in the Sierra, which I mentioned before, the giant sequoia, they seem to be the ones that might be most affected by this drought, and that's largely because not only has it come with warmer temperatures, but it's come with a lower snowpack, and that snowpack is really very important for the giant sequoia, and when they don't have it, they don't get the groundwater recharged. You contrast that to the coast redwoods, and they have still been getting that summer fog. And so they don't seem to be as affected by this current drought as the trees that are growing up in the mountains.
Is there a difference between studying the redwoods and their cousins, the sequoia?
There definitely is. I mean, the giant sequoia that grows up in the Sierra, they seem to be a tree that's much more drought tolerant. They can tolerate, of course, the very cold winters when the snowfall comes. And the coast redwood doesn't seem to be as drought tolerant as that tree that grows up in the Sierra. So there are some differences both in not only where they live, but also in their physiological tolerances to things like drought.
Now, I know that you're interested in the snowpack. You're interested in the growth of the redwoods. What don't you know now? You know, what do I know that I don't know that I would like to know if I could know that?
Well, if there's some things we'd like to know as we march into the future, is how these trees might respond to the projected climate changes that are now kind of being rolled out in many of the models here. So some of those models suggest that things are going to continue to get warmer. Rainfall is probably likely to change in its overall patterns, and particularly in terms of how much of the moisture that hits California actually comes as rain versus a snowpack. And so what we'd really like to try to know as we go into the future is how these new sort of climate challenges that redwoods really haven't seen to this extent in the past, how are they going to respond? Are they going to be able to keep growing? Will their ranges shrink? How will seedling recruitment and forest structure change as we march into a climate change future?
Now, I know that you've been studying redwoods for 25 years. What have you noticed in all those years? What strikes you the most?
I think that the thing that strikes me the most is really, even though they have very narrow ranges, just how resilient they are to some of the factors that are kind of impinging on them. And so even though they've been cut down, they seem to be able to regrow. So they have a great deal of resilience. And I think that's a very important characteristic for redwoods, because it means they're going to be pretty tolerant of the kinds of things that are being thrown at them as the climate changes into the future.
Well, we thank you for taking your time to share your knowledge, and good luck in the next 25 years.
All right. Thanks very much, Ira. Pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you very much. Todd Dawson is professor of integrative biology and environmental science policy at UC Berkeley. We're going to take a break, and after the break, KQED environment reporter Lawrence Summer is going to join us to report on how scientists are using a fungus that's been decimating amphibian populations worldwide, trying to use that same fungus to save the frogs. All coming up after this break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow in San Francisco. Our next story is about California frogs like these. Yep, that's the sound of the mountain yellow-legged frog. It lives high in the Sierra Nevada in alpine lakes, and it's the subject of a bold experiment. Can we immunize amphibians against a deadly fungus by letting them catch it? Joining me now to tell the story is Lawrence Summer, KQED Environment, Water, and Energy reporter. Lauren, good to have you with us. Welcome.
Hi, Ira. Welcome to California.
Tell us this tale of the frog and the fungus.
Yeah, in recent decades, this fungus, the chytrid fungus, has become public enemy number one for amphibians across the globe. It's wiped out thousands of animals here in California alone. And it's particularly nasty because it attacks their skin, you know, something the amphibians depend on to breathe underwater and absorb nutrients. Jesse Bouchel is conservation director at the San Francisco Zoo, and she's been working on fighting this fungus, along with my other guest, Dr. Vance Friedenberg, as an associate professor of biology at San Francisco State University. He worked on the first survey of this fungus in Asia, and he's looking at several possible solutions for preventing its spread in the long run. Welcome both of you to Science Friday.
Hi, Lauren. Thanks.
Thanks for having us.
So, Vance, tell us just what is this fungus and why is it so bad for amphibians?
Well, this fungus, it's a chytridiomycete fungus, which is a group of fungi that are microscopic and live in the water. And these fungi are really unusual in the sense that they infect amphibians and are really the worst case that we know of a single disease in human history. So, for example, it makes what's happened with amphibians makes what happened with humans and the Black Plague look like a drop in the bucket. So,
and it's not new, right? But why is it so bad right now? How is it spreading and why is it so prevalent?
Well, it's a really hard question to answer, actually. So it's spreading in many different ways, but we still don't know all the ways. But one thing we do know is it looks like humans definitely are involved with this. So this fungus is being moved around probably on the backs of amphibians that we have let go by accident. Things like American bullfrogs or African clawed frogs. But they're probably moving around in other ways as well. There's an example in the Caribbean where frogs were in bananas that were shipped from one island to another and caused the decline of the mountain chicken frog, which was really terrible, terrible case.
And you're one of the few scientists that has actually seen what it looks like when this fungus can hit a lake or an area. I mean, what have you seen? What does it look like on the ground?
Well, it's devastating. It truly is. It's devastating. It's one thing that's interesting is it's microscopic, so you can't actually see the fungus itself. But what you do see is when the animals get sick, especially in mass, you see sick and dying animals that dying at a scale that's really not something we're used to seeing in nature. So, for example, in the Sierra Nevada, when I witnessed the die-off of mountain yellowhead frogs from this chytrid fungus, I saw literally tens of thousands of dead frogs littering the shorelines of these beautiful, pristine lakes.
And this species, the mountain yellow-legged frog, is the one that you guys are working on to really study, can we control this fungus? And some of the tadpoles of those infected frogs actually made their way to you, Jesse, at the San Francisco Zoo, right? And by helicopter?
Yes. Well, we have a couple projects going on, but one of them was a helicopter rescue. So it was a salvage operation for a population that, similar to how Vance described it, the biologists went into the field, this really remote site, and found that there were no surviving adults, but there were lots of tadpoles. Basically, that was the last remnant of that entire population in this one area that had been naive to the chytrid fungus previously. So they scaled this operation with the National Park Service, with Fish and Wildlife Service, with the UC Davis biologists that were working there, and they collected every last tadpole and helicoptered them to my zoo and also to the Oakland Zoo, one of our collaborators on the project. It was an amazing thing to see this fire rescue helicopter arrive with basically just like buckets of tadpoles. And they were so excited. They were like, we're saving a species. It was like a moment for them and a moment for us. I mean, it really is a collaborative effort. And we raised them and treated them. And this summer we released about 150 of them back to that lake.
So yeah, tell me what happens when these tadpoles got to the zoo. What did you do exactly?
So when we got them, they were late-stage tadpoles. So basically, the eggs developed into tadpoles. Normally, they last about 3 years as tadpoles in these high-elevation lakes because of the winter season is really long, and so they don't have as much time to develop. So when they came to us, they were pretty late-stage tadpoles and became froglets within a couple of months. So when they became froglets, we treated them against the chytrid fungus. We treated them with an antifungal so that they would no longer have an active infection. That allowed them to be healthy, to grow. And so after about 9 months, we then reinfected them with the chytrid fungus. So this is the whole idea of the immunization. We wanted to stimulate their immune system so that when we released them a couple of months later, their body would recognize the fungus as something to fight against. They'd have antibodies already in their system. So we infected them, let the infection brew to a point that we felt was not life-threatening, but would enable their immune system to kick on. And then we treated them with an antifungal, so a medication to basically get rid of the infection, to get it so it wasn't there anymore, give them a couple of weeks to then get healthy again, strong, eat, and then we release them, hoping that in the wild, when they saw it, they wouldn't die. They would just fight it off on their own.
So kind of like a vaccine almost.
Exactly, exactly. And that's what we're hoping it will be like. And it would just be enough to get these guys to survive to adulthood and be able to breed so that the population would continue, that it wouldn't go extinct.
And so, yeah, what are you seeing, Vance, in the wild? Is this working? Can their immune systems kind of be turned on in a way that when they get hit with this fungus, they're able to fight it?
Well, what we're hoping is that these animals will respond the way that we expect organisms to respond to a pathogen, which is that pathogens don't usually drive their hosts all the way to extinction. And so there's some coevolution usually that happens or adaptations that occur. And so we do know that there are lots of species that actually can handle this chytrid fungus. They tend to be animals that have low levels of infection where it doesn't overwhelm their systems. And so what we're trying to do is we're trying to get them to that point here in California with these naive frogs, naive to that pathogen anyway, trying to get them to that point where they can survive. And so it looks like we certainly have a situation possibly like that in parts of the Sierra Nevada, including where we're reintroducing some of these frogs, where it looks like they really are surviving this pathogen infection.
So the idea is that if they can get through that really bad first onslaught, they can kind of almost evolve to live with it, essentially.
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly the point.
And how long does that take? How long does it take for them to really kind of evolve that ability?
Well, that's a really good question. We don't have the answer to that. But we do know that there are potentially different pathways to that. So one is an actual adaptation from the host itself, from the frog itself, where they may, for example, evolve the ability to create T cells that attack. Their immune systems are relatively similar to ours, actually. They're quite advanced. So they might be able to attack them with T cells or with white blood cells or some other technique that they could use to sort of fight them off immunologically. But there are other pathways as well. For example, there are some species that we think might actually alter their behavior. And in altering their behavior, they're doing something that's basically not good for the fungus. So they might be sort of moving into sunnier, warmer spots where the fungus can't grow as quickly. So they're sort of limiting the growth of the fungus. Other things that could happen is that we're also curious about is the skin microbiome. So all these organisms that live on the skin, mostly bacteria. We found that some of the species of bacteria on frogs and salamanders produce antifungals that actually kill the chytrid fungus as well. So, you know, it's a complicated place out there in the wild. And those things can sort of, we're not really sure which ones are the most important, but being conservation biologists, I think we're working in this crisis situation where we're trying all of them as much as we can, sort of full court press to see if we can get them over that hump of that first initial infection and the big outbreak that happens, to sort of dampen down that outbreak and give these animals a chance to basically get used to having the skin infection that doesn't need to be fatal.
Because obviously this is a huge amount of work for this species, right? I mean, is it really a last-ditch effort to save these mountain yellow-legged frogs?
They are in bad shape. They're in really bad shape. I mean, the decline of the species is dramatic. And one of the things that's so important when we're talking about mountain yellow-legged frogs is that, think of this, most of the habitat that they're in is some of the most protected habitat that we have anywhere in the United States, in the continental United States. And so it's pretty alarming to think that we're losing these animals in places where you can't even ride a bike. You can hike and you can ride a horse, but there's no structures, there's no roads. This is as wild as it gets, and yet we're losing some of these species that have been there for millions and millions of years.
And Jesse, you live with these frogs for a while, right? A year or more. And to release them, it's almost this amazing frog expedition, right? They get packed into these tiny little Tupperware containers and put into backpacks and hiked up the side of the mountain. I mean, what's that like to release them in the wild?
Yeah, it's an adventure for sure. So we have one of our sites is actually you don't have to helicopter in, which is nice. And we do. We pack them up at like 3 a.m. into these individual containers, put them into bear canisters, put them on backpacks, hike 3 or 4 hours up. But, you know, it's amazing releasing them and knowing that they are going to survive in that lake and that they are doing well. And then being able to go back and see them again and knowing that we were instrumental in making sure that there are still frogs in those lakes is amazing. And, you know, I have to give kudos because the California Department of Fish and Wildlife have been working really hard to make these lakes fish-free because, you know, non-native fish are another issue that really threatens this species. And they've cleared those fish out of those lakes so that the frogs can exist. They're not being predated upon. Their eggs aren't being eaten by these fish. And they come on these expeditions with us to release the frogs. And a lot of times they've never seen the frog. And they've been working 10 years in these lakes to clear the fish and restore the habitat. And for them to be able to release the frog is almost, for me, even a better experience because I know how hard and how long they've worked. Of course, for me, it's amazing too because they're like my little kids that I'm releasing out to the wild. But you know, knowing that we're recapturing them and that they're out there still, and we just are waiting to make sure that they can reproduce out there and that they're continuing their genetic line. We're hoping that some of those offspring then will survive and just keep that population moving forward.
And you mentioned the fish. You know, these are invasive fish, right? Fish that aren't supposed to be in these lakes.
A lot of these high alpine lakes never had fish. They were fishless lakes. And so the frogs developed as kind of the top predator in those lakes. Fish were introduced for recreational fishing in a lot of lakes. And in a lot of lakes, there's still going to be tons of fish for recreational fishing. But in some of these lakes that we want to restore for the frog, there doesn't need to be fish there. So few people go there. But yes, they're non-native.
And so, Vance, I mean, this is the big question, right? This method that you guys are experimenting with, can it be used to save other frog species around the world?
Well, I think the jury's still out on that. But this is an excellent place to test that idea. And before we go forward and try to do it in other places, I think we really have to have the flexibility to try these kinds of experiments. But I think, you know, we're not going to be able to inoculate every single frog species in the world, because there are thousands, over 6,000 species of frogs alone in the world. So we're not going to be able to do that. But I think it is possible in some places where we may be able to sort of stem the tide, in the sense, and really keep the fungus from overwhelming these animals. It may be something that we can do. I mean, zoos around the world right now are working to take on threatened species of amphibians from all over the place. And they have many of them in captivity already. And they're so it's sort of like we should try this, because if we don't, we just have these animals in captivity and we're not moving forward.
I'm Lauren Sommer, and this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Yeah, Vance, you mentioned these frogs that are in captivity, right? I mean, what's happened there? Have people kind of been rescuing them from the wild? And maybe those are the cases where this might work the best?
So in North America, we have only a few. In the United States, we have only a few species that are extinct in the wild. And one of them is the Wyoming toad. So the Wyoming toad is actually extinct in the wild, but it's alive in captivity. So, of course, the idea is we want to get those back out into the wild. The mountain yellow-legged frogs here in California have actually gotten pretty close to that level of threat. So their numbers have plummeted dramatically in the field. So we're trying to, by using the zoos to help us raise these animals that are coming from these really threatened populations, we're trying to keep the lines alive and keep them going. But in other parts of the world, for example, in Panama, there was a group of scientists that actually collected a bunch of animals, a bunch of species, in front of a chytrid wave of death. And they brought them into labs, and the chytrid wave swept through and caused the extinction of all the remaining animals in the wild of those species. So at one point, there's been an estimate that we need the capability to keep alive something like 400 to 600 species of amphibians around the world. There's that many that are that threatened right now. Of course, we don't have the capabilities for that at this time, but the zoos have, I don't know the exact number, but I know it's more than 10 species and probably less than about 50 that are alive in captivity. And I hope we hear more about that in the future.
I mean, you can't really release them without a plan, right? But what's also interesting about this fungus is that not all frogs just die immediately, right? There's variation out there.
That's the thing that's been so confounding to scientists, is trying to figure out why. Why is it so different? For here in California, in the Sierra Nevada, the yellow-legged frogs are highly susceptible to the fungus, and they share habitat with the Pacific chorus frogs or tree frogs. And the Pacific chorus frogs can actually handle really high levels of infection. In fact, they compete with those yellow-legged frogs. And then when the yellow-legged frogs get killed off by this infection, their numbers, the chorus frog numbers, have actually increased. So yeah, the susceptibility of species is highly variable. And it can even be variable within a species. So I think a lot of this is we need to understand the context of what's happened with this pathogen as it sweeps into these new populations or these naive populations of hosts. We need to know something about what's the timing of that. Did it happen 2 years ago, or did it happen 40 years ago? And it turns out in California, we have examples now that we're putting together that we know approximately when the fungus invaded different parts of California. Interestingly, there are other parts of the world where the fungus seems to have been around for a very long time. And in those areas, we don't have evidence of mass die-offs from this fungus.
And so some people love frogs because, you know, they're pretty cute, I would say. But what's the importance of saving frogs? I mean, remind us why we care here.
Well, frogs are really important. I mean, for one, they're a group of vertebrates that are over 360 million years old. So they've been around for a really, really long time. They're survivors in the general sense. But they're also really embedded in food webs. So they're one of the most important connectors, for example, for energy between aquatic and terrestrial systems, because they have this multi-biphasic life cycle. But they're also really important because they link together all these different species that are feeding on them.
And Jesse, what's next for this project? What's next for you guys?
Well, obviously, we're continuing to do the immunization. So we have some recent animals that have come in from populations that have been hit by chytrid in a similar situation. The adults are gone. We're trying to restore these tadpoles, bring them up to an immunization size, and then release them. And we're going to continue to do that as needed. But we're hoping that this is not a permanent solution. We're not going to be able to immunize all these frogs forever. But we're just getting, as they need to be done, we're going to be available to help with this.
We're out of time, but thank you, guys. It's been fun, guys. Dr. Jesse Mouchel is Director of Conservation for the San Francisco Zoo, and Franz Friedenberg is Associate Professor of Biology at the San Francisco State University. Coming up next, Ira's back talking about intelligent robots.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Now for a topic we've been talking about, since the dawn of Science Friday 25 years ago, artificial intelligence. The field is on the move this year with some striking examples of what the future could hold. We have a robot surgeon beating a human at stitching a pig's intestines. Self-driving cars are now answering Uber calls in Pittsburgh. And as robots get smarter, they learn more about how we work, start doing more things for themselves. We've heard warnings from futurists like Elon Musk and Stephen Hawking that superintelligence could escape our control. How do we ensure that AI developments are as beneficial as possible? Well, a new center launched by the University of California at Berkeley proposes to focus on ensuring AI is compatible with our needs, while keeping robots under our control, even as they get more advanced. Berkeley Computer Science Professor Stuart Russell is leading the center. Welcome back, Dr. Russell.
Thank you for having me.
And based at Stanford, another group is studying the achievements and potential of artificial intelligence for the next 100 years. It's the AI 100 Project's first report, which is now out, and it looks at the potential properly channeled AI could have for the year 2030. The lead author of that report, Dr. Peter Stone, is a computer science professor at the University of Texas at Austin. Welcome, Dr. Stone.
Thank you.
And if you'd like to talk about how do we make most of AI, how do we take advantage of it, AI's potential, give us a tweet. Our tweet is @SciFry. You can tweet us there. How do we make the most of AI's potential? Tweet us @SciFry. Dr. Russell, how do you define human compatibility AI?
So what we really want to do is make sure that AI systems are provably beneficial specifically to humans. And so I need to unpack that a little bit, if you don't mind.
No, go right ahead. So
first of all, I think we all understand that AI is about making machines intelligent, and that's basically a good thing. Dumb machines are not all that useful. And we already see many of these benefits that you mentioned. And as we approach human-level AI, the ability of machines to solve a wide range of problems and learn all kinds of new subjects, then I think that will really represent a dramatic change in the progress of history, because history is really the result of our minds operating in the world. And if we have access to substantially greater intelligence that we can use as a tool, then that's going to change the direction of history, and hopefully for the better.
So, but why do we need a center for human compatibility? Can't we just say that AI is already human compatible? It does stuff for us?
Yes, so far we've focused on very restricted tasks like playing chess. But if you're Garry Kasparov, right, was it a good thing that Deep Blue beat you?
Right.
From Gary's point of view, probably not. And maybe that illustrates the
Well, they're good
issue.
At sweeping the floors, too. We got those robots that sweep floors, whatever.
And they're good at driving
right.
us around until they crash into the side of a truck and kill the driver.
Mm-hmm.
So the real issue, I think, if you ask an AI researcher, what do we mean by AI, not just the lay version, making machines intelligent, but the technical version, it means making machines that can optimally achieve objectives. And then you say, well, what objectives? And the AI researcher will say, well, that's not my job. That's your job to figure out what your objective is and put it into the machine. And as long as we're putting in small, simple objectives like win the game of chess or drive to the airport, there isn't too much of an issue. But if you put in objectives like make my company as profitable as possible or end hunger for humans. Yeah. Well, there are different ways of doing that. We can end hunger by ending humans. If you ask King Midas, he'll tell you, no, it's very easy for humans to misspecify the objective. He said, I want everything I touch to turn to gold. And he got his food and his drink turned to gold, and he was very unhappy, and he died miserable. So the real issue is that AI is only human compatible if the objectives are consistent with what humans really want.
Mm-hmm.
It's too late when we put in an objective like end human hunger to find out that the machine is busily exterminating humans so that they won't be hungry anymore.
I hate it when that happens.
Yeah, it's a real bummer. So what we're trying to do is change the definition of AI so that getting the right objectives actually becomes part of the job of the field and it isn't just left to the user to specify.
Peter, maybe you can help us hone in on some of the objectives that you see. What are we looking at as you look past and future about AI and human compatibility? What are some of the biggest areas of opportunity right now?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that was one of the main focus areas for the AI 100 report that we came out with. We were given the charge to think ahead to the year 2030 and come up with the likely influences of artificial intelligence technologies on a typical North American city by the year 2030. And before I go into the areas that we focused on, I do think it's important to say that in contrast to what Professor Russell was just saying, one of the leaping off points for the report was to observe that at least in the present day, there is no sort of one artificial intelligence. AI is not one thing. Rather, it's a collection of technologies that require special focus and research towards every application. So there doesn't exist right now, and we don't anticipate in the foreseeable future, at least in the near future, a machine that could be given any goal. But rather, there are technologies that are focused on particular areas. And so the areas we looked at in our report were starting by the one that's probably front and center in everyone's attention right now is transportation. It's clear that there's progress in autonomous vehicles and in other areas of transportation where AI technologies have a huge potential to make an impact in the relatively near term. But there's also great opportunities in healthcare, home and service robots, education, public safety and security, employment in the workplace, and entertainment. And in each of these, there's great potential for AI technologies to improve our lives, as Professor Russell was saying. But there's also barriers and both technical challenges in each of these domains that are sort of unique to each domain, and also social and political barriers that need to be overcome if they're going to achieve their full potential.
Is that why we should bring social scientists in to this conversation about deciding where AI should be going?
Yeah, I think this is a conversation that needs to happen among technologists, but also policymakers and politicians, mm-hmm. social scientists, economists, and on our panel we had people sort of representing all of those areas, because I think for example there is a lot of concern, I think legitimate concern, that AI technologies will affect the employment landscape and the job landscape, and probably not by replacing lots of jobs in the near term, but rather changing the nature of certain jobs. For instance, physicians will certainly not in the near term be entirely replaced by AI technologies, but there will be tools and new tools and skills that they'll have at their fingertips and be able to use. But they'll need to be able to. We'll need to be able to make sure that there's enough transparency that the physicians and the patients are able to trust the recommendations that are made by these technologies. And when it comes to the economy, there's a lot of potential for greater productivity as a whole by society. But there is also danger that there could be even greater concentration of wealth in a smaller number of people's hands. And if we need to start the conversation now about how to sort of make sure that the wealth that's created by AI technologies is treated fairly and equitably.
In fact, I have there are some tweets coming in about that. Muhammad Arthur writes, most programmers are still wealthy white men. How do we make AI better for all people? Stuart, you got any suggestion? Maybe curricula change? Or?
Well, I think there is a very big issue with the demographics of Silicon Valley. I wouldn't say white. I would say white and Asian. I think the technology is spreading throughout the world, and different populations are going to be adopting it and becoming expert in it. But I do see a lot of people saying, well, you know, it's great that robots are going to do all the work because then we can have a guaranteed basic income and anyone who doesn't want to work doesn't have to work. To me, this is just a recipe for disaster because what you end up with is a society of a thin layer of extremely rich owners of technology, a layer of people who serve their personal needs, and then the rest of the population is fed and housed and entertained and pretty much left to their own devices and doesn't have a real function in society. That's not a vision of the future that I, for one, would welcome at all. So we really have to think very hard about what the future shape of an economy is going to be when the material needs of the population can largely be met by fully automated systems.
What's the best way of teaching a robot?
There are a lot of different ways. Peter, for example, works in an area called reinforcement learning, which means that essentially you give the robot a virtual lump of sugar when it succeeds in, or at least partially succeeds in a task, and you wrap it on the knuckles when it doesn't do it right. So this is reward and punishment, and that process can be very effective in getting a robot to learn various tasks, assuming that the human knows when to supply the sugar and when to supply the punishment.
Peter, you agree with that?
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, what about having robots watch what we do? And
so there's many different ways of communicating sort of the teaching signal. So one is by just a reward signal, as Stuart was talking about. There is also an area of research called learning from demonstration, where the robot watches examples of successful behaviors, and this is an active research area as well. There's also there's a channel of reward signal. There's a channel of demonstrations. There can also be advice. Watching a robot or a program do a task and provide it a richer feedback than just good robot or bad robot, but more next time you're in that situation, try doing X instead of Y.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Here in broadcasting from KQED in San Francisco with Stuart Russell of UC Berkeley and Peter Stone of University of Texas at Austin. Do we want to teach robots morality? And whose morality do we teach it?
Yes, and in some sense, everyone's. So one of the objectives of our center is actually to get robots to have the right objectives so they don't go off and do things that make us unhappy after the fact. And there's a process which is related to the idea of learning from demonstrations that Peter just mentioned. It's called inverse reinforcement learning. It's sort of the opposite of the reward and punishment idea. And so what that means is you observe a human's behavior and you try to figure out what objectives the human is trying to achieve. So, for example, if I get up in the morning and I struggle downstairs with my eyes half closed and I press buttons on a funny-looking machine and it makes grinding and hissing and steaming noises, and then this brown liquid comes out and then I feel happy, right? The robot should be able to figure out that my objective in all this is to get a cup of coffee, and then perhaps the next morning it will make the coffee for me and bring it to me in bed. So that's a very simple example. We would like this process to extend so that eventually machines understand the full spectrum of human objectives so that, for example, when we ask it to end hunger, it doesn't go off and exterminate everyone so they stop being hungry.
But as you were saying before, we don't expect the machine that makes us coffee to be the same machine that's going to take on hunger for the whole world.
So I think it's a spectrum. One of the kinds of systems that people are very interested in building right now, within the next 5 years, I think we'll see lots of products, and we're already seeing partial products, is the digital personal assistant. So that's an AI system that looks after your day-to-day life, your calendar, books, your travel. Some executives have very well-trained and expensive assistants who do all this stuff for them. But in fact, we could make this available to pretty much every human being on the planet for, 99 or 29 cents a month or whatever. So imagine what that system is going to do. So you want to go to a meeting and you say, okay, I want to just book me into the closest hotel. So does it book you into the closest hotel where the only room available is the $2,000 a night presidential suite? Or does it put you in, you know, the Hampton Inn down the road for $115? Well, that depends on your preferences.
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
Right? So you might have one preference or the other. And out of the box, the system doesn't know much about you and your preferences. So one of the main things these systems will have to do is to learn the preferences of the individual in order to make good decisions on their behalf, and also to make decisions that don't negatively affect other people. So you might say, I'm very jealous of my calendar. I don't like too many people making appointments. But, you know, then I'm a professor. That means there's a long line of students who can't get their form signed and can't get into classes and so on. So you have to take into account preferences of other people. It starts to get very complicated. And those are the kinds of problems that we will see in the near term. Let alone the problems of exterminating the human race by accident.
Peter, the AI 100 report warns us against unnecessary fear and suspicion of AI. How do you, you know, with futurists like Elon Musk and Stephen Hawking warning us of not to trust AI, how do we trust AI? How do we get to trust it?
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, there are various ways to instill trust. There's one is transparency, so you know, making sure that people understand how something is programmed and what the if it's trained or if there's learning involved, what data it's trained on. Going back to the point on morality, and this is one of the reasons that the center at Berkeley that Stuart's leading is very timely, is that there's as autonomous cars come into to existence, decisions that never had to be made explicitly are going to have to be made explicitly. And, you know, that's where the morality comes in. People talk a lot about the trolley problem. If a car has to make a choice between, you know, saving its a passenger inside the car versus pedestrians outside the car, that's never been something that we've had to explicitly decide about. But with an autonomous car, that somebody's going to need to program that morality, and we need to decide as a society, you know, what are the right decisions?
Well,
but another way for
I got to break my programming inside of me says I got to say goodbye. So I want to thank both of you. It's a great story. We'll get back to this. Dr. Stuart Russell, computer science professor, University of California, Berkeley. Peter Stone, computer science professor, UC Texas at Austin. And one of the last things today before we go, before artificial intelligence takes me over, remember that it's good old-fashioned human smarts that makes programming like Science Friday possible. So please pitch in to support your local public radio station and all the great news and programming they bring you each day. Every day. Our special thanks to Monte Carlos and Dan Bringer here at KQED, Howard Gelman, all the folks at the radio station. We'll see you next week back in New York. I'm Ira Flatow in San Francisco.